Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Gunter Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And in today's director's cut, we discuss China's Belt and Road Initiative. China, under the leadership of its president Xi Jinping, 5 years ago, initiated the so-called Belt and Road Initiative. Earlier on, it was called the Silk Road Initiative, which is a broad initiative to enlarge China's trading routes with many, many countries in the world. Almost more than half of the world's population is included in the Belt and Road Initiative. It's mostly about building infrastructure, building ports, improving roads, and interacting with many countries in Asia, Central Asia, Southeast Asia, but even Latin America and Europe are included in this Belt and Road Initiative. Now, in today's podcast, I'm joined by two Bruegel senior fellows. Uri Dadush is a senior fellow who will come up with a paper. We will publish a paper on China's Belt and Road Initiative. And Alicia Garcia Herrero, who's based in Hong Kong, will also publish a paper on the Belt and Road Initiative and focus in particular on perceptions of the Belt and Road Initiative across the world. Now, perhaps let me start with you, Uri, and thank you for joining us today. Uri, your paper gives an overview of where we stand after 5 years and analyzes the investment that were done and the trade effects that we could foresee. Could you walk us through the main findings of your paper?
Well, first of all, the paper sets the BRI in the context of major international economic initiatives by China, trade agreements, investment agreements, its aid program, and so on and so forth, which have been very active part of the agenda since the opening of China 40 years ago. It also puts it in a global context in that the Belt and Road Initiative has also to be compared with the large set of trade agreements that the United States has initiated over the years. And indeed, the expansion of the European Union from its 6 original members to 28 and the various trade agreements and aid agreements that the European Union has initiated over the years. That's the context. Now, my overall assessment of the Belt and Road, I look at it as a development economist, somebody who worked at the World Bank over many years and originated in a developing country. And I see it overall as a positive thing, essentially because it is a way to stimulate trade with what is or what is soon to be the world's largest economy, and above all, a way to build infrastructure in a situation where many parts of the developing world are desperate for infrastructure investments. The paper also takes a rather dim view of the way that the Belt and Road Initiative has been executed and implemented. So if you like, my problem is not with the strategy or with the legitimacy of China's effort, which is obviously the problem with some observers, rather with the way that the initiative is being executed, and particularly the lack of due diligence or the inadequacy of the due diligence process and of the placing of very large infrastructure investments within the context of macroeconomic and fiscal sustainability.
Uri, perhaps let me follow up on your last point that you made on the implementation. I mean, there have been a number of very important criticisms directed towards China. I think most observers that have analyzed this, including Alicia, have pointed out that, of course, such an infrastructure trade facilitation initiative will generate trade. And I think we have estimated that there will be significant trade generating effects from such an initiative, which is what you would expect. And I think which you, as a development economist, rightly say, consider positive, because trade is good for these developing economies. Now, there have been a number of very important criticisms of the Belt and Road Initiative concerning the implementation. So one was, I think the point was that there's a lack of transparency. So in other words, countries do get into debt, and nobody knows how much debt they actually get into. So there was a major article recently in a German magazine, Der Spiegel, which focused on, I think, on Laos, and argued that, you know, basically Laos got into a lot of debt and gave a lot of collateral, and that the investment is way too big given the size of the economy, so that in the end, you know, it's an out-proportionate level of debt. Another, and perhaps you can comment on this criticism, another important criticism that is given is the lack of any environmental strategy and consciousness in this initiative. I mean, many of the investments are not only directly bad for the environment, but there's also no real climate strategy. And so there's a big worry that once you implement Belt and Road the way it's being done now, I mean, we will have coal-fired power plants, we have street infrastructure that will basically lock in very negative environmental and climate policies for decades to come. So perhaps you can give us a sense of when studying the Belt and Road Initiative, where do you see these two points? So the lack of transparency on debt, which is a big problem for other external donors, as well as the environmental climate issues.
Yeah, so first of all, I agree with the critique, as I mentioned, on the excessive indebtedness and the excessively large projects relative to the capacity to pay in some instances. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is the result of inadequate due diligence and consideration. So when the World Bank does a lending program for a country, they always look at the macroeconomic sustainability and fiscal sustainability of the new debt obligations that are created. It's not clear that the Chinese are doing that. Now, the best analysis that has been done that I have seen is by the Center for Global Development, that looked at virtually all the countries that have a significant BRI component, mm-hmm. and concluded that there were about 8 of them, mm-hmm. where you have a combination of fiscal overextension, excessive debt to start with, and then large projects that are coming on stream. And indeed, Laos was one of the countries that they identified. They identified some others, you know, mm-hmm. smaller countries like Montenegro, mm-hmm. For example. So essentially, I agree with the criticism, and it needs to be dealt with. Let me say, as a parenthesis, not as a defense, that this is not the first time that we have overeager lenders causing default problems or potential for default problems. I could mention the Asian financial crisis. I could mention the subprime crisis in the United States. These are private sector events. But I could also mention the huge lending to poor countries, which eventually led to the Paris Club and the highly indebted countries initiative. I could also regrettably mention the sovereign debt crisis in the Eurozone is an example of excess. So the Chinese are not the only ones who have fallen into this trap. But the Belt and Road Initiative is big, and it is new, and it is very important that they take corrective measures. On the environment, again, this is not an area where I've been able to go into depth, but certainly this is one of the issues that need to be looked at. in a proper due diligence. At the same time, I have to confess to you, and this is not only my view, but the view of many development economists, that in the lending by the multilateral institutions and some of the bilateral ones, we have gone too far in terms of the safeguards, to the point effectively where we're no longer doing the projects. Or we are doing the projects on a time basis, which is not unusually 10 years from the beginning to the end of the project, or even 15 years between the beginning and the end of the project. The net effect is that a lot of countries are just not bothering. You know, they just cannot justify these kinds of expenses and time delays, et cetera, et cetera. And so somehow we need to move towards a situation where the vitality and the speed and the capacity of execution that we see in the BRI infrastructure projects continues, while at the same time moderating the negative elements, which are in some instances environmental damage and the fiscal complications that they create.
Okay, let me turn to Alicia, who is publishing a paper on the perception of the Belt and Road Initiative. Alicia, you've analyzed a large number of media articles. Can you walk us through first of all what you did and what are your main findings?
Sure, thanks very much for the opportunity. So basically used a big data, open access big data platform called GDELT to analyze the image of the Belt and Road Initiative. In that regard, what we are trying to figure out is whether this initiative is perceived positively or negatively by the media as a whole in every single country, as I said, that is reported. And what we find, interestingly, is that there doesn't seem to be any difference or any statistically relevant difference in the image of the Belt and Road for countries which belong to this initiative and countries which do not belong. So we also try to identify the general image, which is positive on average, but there's massive differences across regions. The most negative region is actually South Asia, with very specific cases, of course, India, but even more so the Maldives and other countries in Sri Lanka as well, being relatively negative to this initiative. The most positive one is Africa. And basically, everybody else lies in between. Europe lies in between as well, with massive differences across European countries. So interestingly, the most positive is a non-BRI member in Europe, namely the Netherlands, while the most negative is a BRI member within Europe, Poland, and within the European Union, Poland, and within Europe, Bosnia. So these are the two most negative countries in Europe. And interestingly, they've received funding from China to build infrastructure. So why is this the case? We then try to analyze, looking at the actual news in this big data set, what is the reason for this negative view? And we find that the most common reason is trade concerns. It's not debt, it's not political interference, it's not even investment. I imagine excessive investment from China, which could be an issue, say, in Central Europe. Or no, it's actually trade. And why is it trade? And this brings me back to an article we published a couple of years ago on the benefits, actually, ironically, of trade, of the Belt and Road Initiative regarding trade. The benefits were actually across the globe, of course, much less so for the US or Japan, because they are kind of cut out of this improvement in infrastructure, but they were very relevant for Europe, especially Central Europe, which happens to be the most negative in our analysis. So how come this obvious, quote-unquote obvious, or at least that's what we found, benefits of somebody else supposedly paying for an improvement in your transport infrastructure, which will allow you to improve trade relations with the world, not only with China, how come these countries are so negative. And when you look at the actual media, what you find is that countries are worried about excessive dependence on China in their trade relations. Because maybe their deficits, trade deficits, bilateral trade deficit with China will widen, or because China will become the most relevant, if not, of course, not the only, but the overly relevant trade partner, especially as much as imports are concerned. So it's an issue of dependence from China that is very clear in our analysis. And I guess, one could think about how the Chinese authorities should perhaps take this into account. And the most obvious measure I would take if I were the Chinese leadership is to think about trade deals with these countries. Yeah, I mean, China is trying hastily as a response to the trade war, U.S.-led trade war, to come up with trade deals with many, many countries in the world. It's trying to put more pressure on RCIP, this ASEAN-based multilateral or regional free trade agreement, but also bilaterally. So I guess trade deals are important for countries receiving lending from China to build transport infrastructure, to realize that they can re-export to China, that they won't be dependent on a growing trade deficit. So this is perhaps the most important conclusion from our report.
Alicia, perhaps let's push a little bit more on the trade discussion. So one of the points you just made is that there is a need for trade deals. Now, you also mentioned in a different context that the way the Belt and Road Initiative is constructed is not multilateral, but it's very much centered around China. And you mentioned that this is also sort of not in line with the more multilateral approach of ACP or even WTO. So what do we know about sort of how this initiative will impact existing trade agreement? And I think I also want to bring Uri on this, but let's start with you. I mean, where do you see this initiative that at the end of the day covers more than half of world population? So this is really major. But if it's not multilateral, is it and all centered around China? I mean, does it hinder trade among third countries? Let's say Laos and Cambodia, can they trade less with each other due to this this initiative? Or shouldn't the infrastructure effects be so dominant and so positive that at the end of the day, yes, it's centered around China, but you know, the infrastructure can be used by everyone, right? The street can be used by everyone, the ports can be used by everyone, so that you know, you will also see multilateral trade creation.
So on the question of multilateral versus hub and spoke, which is what I think really is the Belt and Road today, I actually think that it's going to be very difficult for China to move to a multilateral approach to the Belt and Road Initiative. And the reason being that when one looks at both the way the corridors have been designed, the most obvious one is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. These are really bilateral relations. So that corridor doesn't basically leave Pakistan all the way to China, anywhere in Afghanistan or India. So meaning it's really very obvious that this is a connection, kind of an exclusive connection. Of course, somebody else could use it. Well, this we need to come to terms as to how these things have been agreed upon. Because if you think about Hambantota port in Sri Lanka, it's now a 99-year lease after the fact that Sri Lanka had with that port is unknown. I mean, will it be a commercial port? Will it be perhaps a military port, which are the rumors that run around in Sri Lanka, or just a port that has exclusive or at least preferential access to Chinese ships or trade more generally. So you know, I think that the way the Belt and Road Initiative is being designed, which is a hub and spoke, has a reason. It's not a coincidental design. If you look at the financing also, it's actually not multilateral either. It's 90+% of the Belt and Road projects have been financed by China's policy banks, not at any cost, because these banks' balance sheets have actually ballooned, and there is now issues about potential non-performing loans. Imagine all of the loans of China Development Bank to Venezuela, for example. Yeah, I mean, or again, this Hambantota port, which was kind of the asset that could be seized in exchange for non-payment so far of a debt from Sri Lanka versus China. So if you think about all of that, if the financing has been bilateral, because the role of the AIB, let alone the World Bank, has been extremely limited. Last time I checked the webpage of the AIB, I think it was no more than 9 billion, something like that. And we're talking about 400 billion already being spent. So, you know, it's literally not relevant. So I think that because the financing is bilateral and the corridors are not, again, Pakistan being the most relevant, but even the others have kind of a unique direction, yeah? And yes, maybe uniting several countries, but towards China, this is not like a, it's really a hub and spoke model, and the financing as well is bilateral. I just think that it's going to be very difficult to move to a multilateral endeavor unless China gets into problems in financing the whole thing and needs to kind of share the projects and thus the cost of the projects.
Uri, so how does it interact with the multilateral trading system, and how do you see that?
Well, first of all, I agree with Alicia that this is not going to become a multilateral initiative and should not become a multilateral initiative, because if it becomes a multilateral initiative, we're going to end up where we started, which is where we are not getting infrastructure projects done. So my recommendation in the paper is that there be more interaction with the multilateral system so that there is a learning happening on both sides from this initiative. And indeed, China has signed a memorandum of understanding with 5 or 6 other multilateral development banks, and they are now in the 5th or 6th meeting in order to exchange views, etc. In terms of the effect on global trade, which is, I think, in a way, what you're intending by asking the multilateral implications, I believe the overall impact on international, on global trade of the initiative is going to be highly positive. There's nothing new in the fact that a bilateral trade agreement is a bilateral trade agreement, okay? These are the agreements of the European Union that are bilateral between Japan and et cetera, and the U.S., of course. These are bilateral agreements. However, what we have seen is that through bilateral agreements, you do have a process of what they call competitive liberalization, where, in effect, countries are then taking into account, in order to erode the preferences that have been gained by these bilateral initiatives, they initiate their own bilateral initiative. And I could easily argue that the bilateral deals that China is initiating are, in fact, a response to the bilateral deals that Japan, the United States, Europe have already initiated with a number of countries. So I see that as positive. And as you mentioned, Guntram, yes, there may be some examples where it's kind of a very privileged infrastructure corridor. But at the end of the day, when you're building ports, which is what they're doing, and airports in throughout Latin America and Africa and Asia, you are building an infrastructure that is globally usable and will promote international trade. And that is one of the reasons to be supportive of the initiative.
Okay, I think we've covered various aspects of the Belt and Road Initiative. Our time after half an hour, I think, is up. Thank you to both of you, Uri and Alicia, for your great contribution. And we look forward to furthering and continuing that debate. Thank you.